Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The intelligence of a woman who has been closely monitoring and contributing to the good guys mightily in that war for quite some time is, I'm very pleased to say, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. She is Diana West, a best-selling author, now with two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can also follow her at dianawest.net. She's been a columnist. She's a continuing contributor to Daily Caller and other outlets, and we're always delighted to have her with us for her insights into particularly the character of this war for the free world that often goes unaddressed or at least ill-considered, and that is the home front, for one thing, but also the sort of cultural aspects of the effort to take down Western civilization from enemies, well, foreign as well as domestic. Diana West, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, where to begin? We had an election yesterday. One of the outcomes that has been resolved, to my way of thinking, quite satisfactorily, was the rejection as the Democratic candidate for governor of Michigan of one Abdul El Sayed. I'm interested in what you can share with us about Dr. El Sayed and the significance of his candidacy and of his defeat at the polls.
Well, the significance has now been overshadowed by his defeat in this particular election. We've been talking about him as exemplifying the red-green axis in a perfect form, being a radical Muslim, bringing in the Sharia thread into our democratic system, as well as being a very radical progressive out to abolish ICE. So he was combining both of these strands of thought in his candidacy. And I think what became very significant for our wider general election coming up, or the midterms coming up, is the fact that he was embraced by the leaders of the progressive wing of the party, the socialist wing of the party, Senator Sanders, and the primary winner from New York, Ocasio-Cortez, who came to Michigan to try to drive him over the finish line in this primary that was held. And they failed. And I think that in itself becomes an extremely significant marker, because they put it out there, they put it on the line. This is the blue wave of 2018. And in this crucial contest, it fell short.
Yeah, it seems to me it's more the red-green wave, if anything else. As long as we're color coding. And I just wanted to call our listeners' attention to a terrific piece at the American Thinker that Matthew Vadim wrote on this very subject of kind of the personification of the red-green axis, the red of the hard left, the green of the Islamists in Abdul El Sayed that appeared yesterday. And Diana, you know, the thing that's striking to me is El Sayed is not someone who just appeared out of nowhere. I believe he has been groomed and promoted, as are others, by some estimates as many as 90, there may be even more, candidates who are not simply Muslims, that's not the issue, but are really Sharia supremacists, running for all kinds of offices across the country, and being very aggressively promoted and funded and supported in other ways by something called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. And I would just say, as an aside to our listeners, Diana, to check out a terrific book on this subject, Star Spangled Sharia, and also one by Matt Vadim about the Red-Green Axis called Team Jihad, both of which are available for free as downloads at securefreedom.org. So, Diana, what are you making at the moment of this prospect for a blue wave, if you will, a red-green, pick your colors, as we speak? There seems to be some evidence that Republicans are having a hard time and may well have a harder time in November. But what's behind this? And when you use the term progressive, I know that that's not quite as direct a way of characterizing this as you are often given to. Help explain what's behind it.
Yes. I mean, progressive is the euphemism for socialist. And socialist can be described as Marxist, people who revere Marx or the goals of Marx. So we are looking at the same old problem we've been having for 150 years and more on this same issue. But I think in terms of what we're looking at and trying to digest the recent election results, it's actually quite a strong win for Republicans, Trump supporters, because not only is there this effort to create this quote blue wave, which is the unfortunate branding that's being thrust upon us by the media and the left, is the fact that in the face of the unbelievable 24/7 propaganda against President Trump, against his supporters, against candidates in his mold, in the America First MAGA tradition that he has forged, we still saw some tremendously key victories last night and defeats, as we've just discussed, but certainly on the win column, looking at certain seats that held. When we look at Ohio, we don't yet know exactly the results in Kansas as we speak, but we're looking at strong showings despite the incessant propaganda against this president, despite the treatment of these incredibly roaring economic figures that we're being treated with and watching as the country revives, as jobs return, as we see just this tremendous economic performance under the Trump policies. These are all things that are being hidden by the media and disparaged and cut down. So if there are even victories in this environment, in this information battlefield that actually is our news space at this point, that's highly significant and highly positive going forward toward the midterms.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, let's hope it's so. Let me ask you, Diana, this is a very big topic and we won't have time to do justice to it, but very quickly, you've written at your dinawest.net blog about censorship in New Zealand. Just give us very quickly an appreciation of what's going on there and the importance of it for our own polity.
Well, this particular story is just a microcosm of what's going on all over the world, but it is a very stark window into this effort to censor, to eliminate a whole school of political thought on the conservative side. And when you are censoring the likes of Stefan Molyneux and Lauren Southern as not being fit to be heard in the public square, you have a totalitarian-style society. That's what we're seeing all over the Western world at this point. And their case exemplifies the treatment. And I do recommend people watch the discussion by the New Zealand journalists essentially celebrating the absence of free speech in their country.
Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so with you next week. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us soon. And next up, we will speak with Dr. Lawrence Sellin, the former Army veteran who has been one of our go-to people on South Asia, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Dr. Lawrence Sellin, also Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves retired, a man who has served in combat with our special forces, our infantry and chemical and medical services. He has been decorated for his time in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's extraordinary Renaissance man, it turns out, with a background in business and behavioral and neurological sciences. He's really a go-to guy, especially with respect to South Asia. And we've asked him to join us again to talk with him a little bit about developments there, including this phenomenon known as the debt trap that China is using to advance its, well, I think of it as colonial empire building. Lawrence Sullen, it's good to have you, sir. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank.
In the so-called China-Pakistan economic corridor context, Lawrence, there is a concerted effort being made to build infrastructure on the Chinese nickel, only it turns out that it's, you know, like a payday loan with the expenses being covered, but only at a huge cost that proves unsupportable. Tell us a little bit about how this is operating, particularly in Pakistan, and with what effect?
Yes, that's right, Frank. The Chinese debt trap strategy, is, if I could summarize it, is that China offers a loan for an infrastructure project in a country. And that infrastructure project is built by Chinese workers using Chinese equipment, which the country has to pay for. So essentially, the country is paying China twice. And at the same time, there's a net outflow of jobs from that country and a net inflow of Chinese products. And at the same time, there's a development of a semi-permanent Chinese colony in that country. So that's how the debt trap works. Now, in Pakistan specifically, as you mentioned, International Monetary Fund is considering giving another bailout to Pakistan. Now, if that goes through, that is the 13th bailout of Pakistan by the IMF since 1982. And Pakistan has still not paid back the IMF for the 2013 bailout. And just in the last 12 months, Pakistan has borrowed $10 billion, half of which came from China. So if there's an IMF bailout of Pakistan, essentially that money is going to China and subsidizing Chinese debt trap strategy. Now, I hasten to add that this is unnecessary because the wealthy Pakistanis have hidden assets of $350 billion. Now, if the Pakistan government just taps into 5% of that, they wouldn't need the IMF loan or the IMF bailout.
This is of particular concern, Lawrence Sullen, as you have been telling us about for some time now, because one of the upsides for China of this debt trap strategy is that it winds up not only essentially having a lock on these countries in which it engages in this, whatever resources they have and markets and so on, but they are also expropriating effectively bases and airfields and ports and the like. Talk a little bit about how that's eventuating in Pakistan at the moment and what the strategic implications might be, especially if, well, U.S. tax dollars are at work in subsidizing this operation through the vehicle of the IMF.
Yes, that's exactly right, Frank. Pakistan, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which you mentioned, is really the soft power component of Chinese attempts for global domination. Now, underlying that is a hard power component, which is the development of bases. Now, the first overseas base that the Chinese had was in Djibouti, and it was also based on the same debt trap principle. What is following in Pakistan is it has been reported some months ago that the Chinese will establish a naval base in the Gwadar region of Balochistan, which is at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, and will dominate essentially the vital sea lanes and the oil flow within that region.
This is something that, again, the Chinese are very keen to be able to do, to project power in the Indian Ocean, to encircle India, as well as to ensure that they're able to monitor, at the very least, if not dominate, those sea lanes. This is a very big deal. I'm pleased to see that Bill Gertz is reporting the United States Senate is showing some signs of life with respect to all of this and essentially warning the president to discourage the IMF from extending yet another loan to Pakistan. Let's back the lens up for a minute, if we could, Lawrence Sullen, to sort of a more general appreciation of what Pakistan and China are up to in the region with respect specifically to Iran and Afghanistan. Can you give us sort of a 30,000-foot level assessment of what's going on there, especially against the backdrop of Chinese interests in Afghanistan and evidently talks taking place between the United States and the Taliban?
Well, at a high level, Frank, you have to recognize that China is orchestrating things in South Asia. So now that Iran is getting on the ropes because of President Trump's actions in terms of sanctions against Iran, Iran is trying to cozy up to Pakistan, and China would like to have stability in that region and essentially control of the countries there. They already have control of Pakistan. They would like to have more control of what Iran is doing. Now, the United States, as you know, has been engaged in talks with the Taliban recently. But the Chinese, in fact, have been talking to the Taliban for the past year secretly. So China has its own plan for how any peace process will occur in regard to Afghanistan. And because Pakistan is so closely tied to China and Pakistan essentially controls the Taliban, they might have the upper hand in South Asia.
And what is your assessment of China's long-term goals with respect to Afghanistan? There's a lot of natural resources there, notably some that could make for very lucrative mining. Is that a big piece of what they have in mind, or is it a sort of larger strategic purpose beyond that?
No, that's their main goal, as you point out. The Chinese would like to dominate Afghanistan as a client state in the same way they want to dominate Pakistan as a client state.
And most of the world, I think it's fair to say.
The Chinese game plan is essentially the same globally. It's all based on their Belt and Road Initiative, of which the flagship now is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So essentially, if that is stopped, the whole BRI project, Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, is, I think, dead in the water.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for doing just that. You mentioned that this naval facility will be in Balochistan. It's an ethnically separate part of Pakistan. And you've described with us in the past, Colonel Doctor, as I like to call you, the fault lines that those sectarian or ethnic differences constitute. Walk us through how that might play in the success of China's efforts to dominate this region.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. As I said, the Belt and Road Initiative is China's main attempt for global domination, and that is very dependent on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is dependent on Balochistan. Now, Balochistan at one time was actually independent, but was forcibly incorporated into Pakistan in 1948, and there's been a festering insurgency there since then. So the Baluchis would like to be independent, and it really is a fault line and a real potential pain point for Pakistan and China indirectly. And that is why actually the Pakistan military is essentially in total control of Balochistan. So this is a point of attack which the United States should consider.
Let me just go back to the Taliban for a minute with you, Lawrence. Of course, in your two tours in Afghanistan, you were engaged in combat operations against these guys. What, if any, prospect is there of something useful coming out of negotiations with them, especially given the Chinese play and their ability to exercise their will, presumably through, if not, you know, over the Pakistani interlocutors?
Well, I think we have to recognize that the Taliban cannot exist without Pakistan. So Pakistan and again, China are in control of the situation. So I think in the long term, the United States has much less leverage with the Taliban than China and Pakistan do. So I think that's a serious consideration for U.S. policymakers.
So if we were to engage in such talks, is it essentially tantamount to surrender?
Well, I personally, I don't know if it'll go anywhere, because if the Chinese are controlling Pakistan and Pakistan is controlling the Taliban, they're holding all the cards. So I think in the long term, based on the current situation, we have no cards to play. So China is, in essence, controlling the outcome of any peace process.
Yeah. So this brings us back to trying to look at how we might change the correlation of forces, among other things, by working perhaps with the Baluchis to make the lives of both the Pakistanis and the Chinese more difficult in this region. Dr. Selim, thank you for taking the time with us today. As always, your expertise on the region is incredibly appreciated, and we look forward to a further visit with you in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Horowitz about immigration and crime in the 2018 elections and American sovereignty and more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. One of the great treats that I'm able to serve up here at Secure Freedom Radio periodically is the chance to visit with one of the brightest guys I know, certainly in the public policy arena. He is the inimitable Daniel Horowitz. He is a fixture these days at Conservative Review, where he is the author of The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. He's a senior editor there and has featured gig on CRTV as well. He is the author of one of the most incredibly important books of recent memory. It is Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. And it seems each time we talk with him, there's yet another example of the sapping of our sovereignty at the hands of the unelected judges. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. Let's talk about the latest of these travesties.
Absolutely. And even when Congress is out in August, the courts are working overtime.
They are indeed. So DACA, again, is this unconstitutional action. Even Barack Obama acknowledged that before he did it. And yet a federal judge is saying that what Donald Trump has done to reverse that unconstitutional act is itself unconstitutional. Explain this to us.
You know, to me, this should be the Waterloo of judicial supremacy. This should be the moment where it finally stops. And the reason for that is this is the case where the courts have finally taken it to a degree that the executive cannot do it. So usually, typically when you have an activist court, they'll take a policy that is discretionary. You don't have to do it, and they'll say you have to do it. Here the court is jumping two steps. Trump must not do it, right? He cannot unilaterally grant affirmative benefits to people that pursuant to longstanding immigration law have to be deported. Yet the court is now saying you must violate immigration law. You must violate national sovereignty. And again, this is not just about not deporting them. The judge is saying you have to issue them work permits, social security cards, visas.
And wait a minute, not just the current roster of these characters, but anyone who wants to apply going forward, as best I can tell, too. I mean, this is cloud cuckoo land, I think is the only way to describe it.
It's beyond belief. And there's nothing more to say other than, you know, if the president decides to follow this, he would be breaking the Constitution.
Right. So the state of Texas is one of several that is filing suit in court, arguing that actually this is unconstitutional and cannot be supported. That is going to go before a judge who has in the past ruled pretty sensibly on DACA. What do you think the chances are this is going to wind up again with a difference between these districts? I guess there are two others that ruled more or less along the same lines as this Bush judge, John Bates. But that ultimately, this is going to have to be resolved by the Supremes. And how do you think that's going to turn out?
Well, again, I think it should be resolved by the political branches of government and keep the courts out of immigration as they've been kept out for 200 years altogether. But absent that, I relish this moment because it's going to show and expose this judicial supremacy for the circus that it is. Think about it. You're going to have one district judge saying you must issue Social Security cards to illegals. And now you're going to have another district saying you mustn't, you cannot. It's going to be violating the Constitution. So, you know, it's mutually exclusive. It's not like one saying you may do it and one saying you can't do it. One saying you must and one saying, you know, you cannot.
Splitting the difference is presumably not an option in this case.
Exactly. You know, which just brings out the point that this needs to be decided by the political branches. And we can't have any district judge just simply setting national policy, border policy. Yeah, we'll go to the Supreme Court, but I mean, again, if we're going to continue giving the courts this much power, it would be like, you know, me having the power to, arrest Floyd Mayweather and say, hey, you know, I'll beat you up if you don't give me $100. I mean, district judges don't have any power to enforce this. They don't have executive power to issue visas. And I think the administration needs to ensure they only use their power in concert with the Constitution.
Yeah. It seems eminently sensible. It seems to be kind of the way the framers envisioned this working, but it doesn't certainly seem to be the way it's working at the moment. Let me talk to you about one other thing that's not seemingly working very well, and that is the budget process up on Capitol Hill. And Daniel Horowitz, you have been warning for a long time and very sensibly about the failure of the Congress to do its job through the normal appropriations process. And the failure thus far, at least, of the president to use his veto pen to try to impose some discipline on it. He has said he will not sign another one of those monster omnibus bills that he was induced to sign last year. But it certainly seems as though something along those lines is teeing up once again with horrific implications for, you know, what's left of budget discipline. And for that matter, I would argue the politics of this as well. Why is the president seemingly so reluctant to use one of the most important instruments of his office, namely the power to veto legislation?
You know, our founders thought that the veto pen would make the president a de facto king, that he'd be able to extort anything he wants from Congress, which is why they eventually lowered the threshold during the debate in the Constitutional Congress for overriding the veto from a 3/4 majority to 2/3. But it's still hard to muster 2/3. You know, it's a mystery to me. He loves to wield the bully pulpit when he feels that he has it. And this is the biggest pulpit he has, that veto pen. Because, you know, by my count, he has signed 5 budget bills and debt ceilings that codify Democrat priorities. This is the one where he could defund sanctuary cities, fund the wall, go after the courts by, you know, blocking their decisions, kicking them out of immigration, changing some criminal alien statutes and asylum and these unaccompanied alien children. This all needs to be dealt with. And Republicans anyway, as we see from last night's election, they need a narrative headed into November because they really don't have one because Congress hasn't been doing anything. So I think this is his last chance. And the conservative movement needs to back the president on this and say, look, we have your back. Issue that veto threat every day from now until September 30th that you will only sign a budget bill that has your immigration priorities. Frankly, if he doesn't do it now, he's never going to do it because he's not going to get 60 votes in the Senate, even if he has 2 terms in, you know, in the White House.
Yeah, and it could be considerably worse than that, losing a House or two perhaps along the way. Let me turn finally to something that the president has generally been pretty sensible about, as far as I can tell, and yet people around him are not, and people he has taken to his bully pulpit to denounce very explicitly have been championing, namely what you call the jailbreak legislation. Talk a little bit about what's going on with that, Daniel Horowitz, and why it is of such concern.
You know, this is an even bigger head scratcher, but this is what happens when you don't have a smart, focused, principled conservative movement that's focused on policy and legislation and what's going on and being vigilant and not breaking their principles. You know, I'm not too old in this business, Frank, as you well know, but I'm old enough to remember a time when every Republican was tough on crime and even a lot of Democrats felt the need to go along with that. Now all the kids in Washington are supporting Jailbreak, just deracinating all of the front-end sentencing, policing tactics, everything that led to the miraculous drop in crime over the past two decades. Now crime is going up again because sentencing has been going down consistently. The prison population has been going down despite, you know, their complaints about it. There's legislation that now passed the House, and they want to augment it with other bad stuff in the Senate that will give early release to a number of the most hardened federal criminals, fentanyl, heroin traffickers, firearms violators, felons. And these are guys that are usually arrested for doing really bad stuff, but they plead down to just drug charges. But, you know, this is a time of the worst drug crisis. And yet the Koch brothers that have their representatives in the White House staff are getting the president to support this with the help of Jared Kushner. And conservatives are nowhere to be seen on this. And the president is no different from anyone else in the sense that, you know, he might have good instincts and intuition, but he will gravitate to the strongest gravitational pull. And that is not the conservative position on this issue.
Let me just ask you, because you've said something that strikes me as bizarre on its face. And that is that we're going to be releasing serious felons, hardened criminals. Oh, by the way, probably not a few jihadis among them, if not because they were put in to jail for their jihadism, but at the very least, they became jihadis in jail. But Daniel Horowitz, we're told by the proponents of this jailbreak bill that these are people who, I don't know, got picked up with a dime bag of dope and have just been horribly mistreated by the judicial system. And mostly it's because they're black on top of everything else. So can you try to make sure that we all understand the ground truth here?
Sure. The reality is we're talking about the federal prison population, not the state prison population. You're not in federal prison for being a low-level drug pusher. These are the top-level traffickers that are usually responsible for putting hits out on people, armed robbery, things like that. But the thing is, because we have a leaky justice system, it's too lenient, not too strong. It is so doggone hard to land a conviction. So often they wind up pleading down, but if you look at their sentencing report, you could see their full history. They often have a long rap sheet in the state system. The federal prosecutors will only go after people who are top-level drug traffickers, often arrested for murder or armed robbery initially. And by the way, there's an element of one of these bills that will reopen sentencing for juvenile murderers, those that were convicted of murder as juveniles. So these are not just low-level crimes.
Daniel Horowitz, we will be covering this closely, and I hope with your help, as always, Conservative Review and all of the other outlets that you employ so effectively, including this program. And I want to thank you for all of that good work and commend once again to our listeners your terrific book, really seminal book on stolen sovereignty. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch joins us next. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by Bill Marshall. He is investigator who is these days performing incalculably important service at Judicial Watch, where he serves as one of their senior gumshoes, if I can use that expression in the best sense of the word. He does incredibly important work supporting Judicial Watch's Freedom of Information Act requests and seeing what can be done to find out what on earth is going on that Congress seems incapable of ferreting out, notably in the Department of Justice, the FBI, the various investigations of Hillary Clinton's emails and the Donald Trump campaign and on and on. Bill, it's so good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking some time.
My pleasure, Frank. Glad to be back.
Well, I wanted to ask you about a development that is just turned up in this regard, involving a fellow by the name of Bruce Orr, who, as I understand it, was during the Obama administration, the number four ranking official in the Department of Justice, evidently very much in the thick of some of the shenanigans that that you've been trying to unravel through your various Freedom of Information Act requests. I saw this tweet from a man I admire greatly, Congressman Mark Meadows, to the effect that he said, quote, "Critical development. New emails obtained by Congress show Chris Steele," that would be the author of the dodgy dossier, "was secretly funneling information to the FBI in 2017 through senior DOJ official Bruce Orr, even after the FBI claimed Steele was, quote, terminated, unquote, for leaking to the media in November 2016. You are, I know, trying to find out what Bruce Orr was up to as well. Can you help us make sense of this revelation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, I think this was already somewhat out there, this special relationship that Bruce Orr had with DOJ, with Steele and frankly, the FBI. You recall that Steele, of course, had been funneling information to the FBI, which was used as the predicate, if you will, for the investigation of the Trump campaign with the salacious and unverified allegations. Well, after the FBI terminated its relationship with Christopher Steele, the Fusion GPS, who was employing Christopher Steele and was in turn employed by the Hillary campaign, continued to funnel information into the government via Bruce Orr. Now Bruce Orr's wife is Nellie Orr, right? Who's this Russia expert who was directly employed either as an employee or as a contractor by Fusion GPS. So you have this weird marital bridge between the Hillary campaign via Fusion GPS and Nellie Orr and her husband, who was the, I believe, the associate deputy attorney general at the time at DOJ. So while FBI terminates its relationship with Chris Steele, they renew the relationship effectively, or the government does, through this Bruce Orr, Nellie Orr conduit, right?
This is really the personification of swampiness, isn't it? That you've got this nexus that is unofficial or quasi-official, but operating in a very insidious way. And Bill Marshall, you have been, again, doing incredibly important spade work in trying to ferret out from the Peter Strzok emails and the Jim Comey emails information that would shed further light on these kinds of relationships and these kinds of, seemingly very unsavory, if not downright illegal, kinds of activities. Tell us where you think things stand at the moment in terms of your efforts to get access to this information through the official channels.
Right. Well, I know you recently saw our latest legal victory in the in one of our many battles with the government, our court battles. One of my requests to get access to Comey's memos to the file that he wrote following conversations that he had with Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, John McCain, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden. All right, I had sent a request back in May of 2017 for all these, you know, memos to the file that he wrote after conversations with these senior officials, as well as notes that were produced as a result. Well, the FBI never responded to my request. I mean, they acknowledged it, but they never issued it what we call a determination letter saying whether they actually have records or not. So we sued them. We also sued in that same lawsuit on behalf of Daily Caller News Foundation for a related request that they had made for Comey records. Well, the FBI, of course, they stonewall at every opportunity. This is sort of de rigueur now for the FBI. They've always been obstructionist in dealing with and our dealings with them, but they've taken it to a new plane, you know, of obstruction. And we've had a seminal victory in that case because one of our brilliant attorneys, Michael Bekesha, who's representing me in this case, had the foresight to request a preservation, that the court issue a preservation order in that particular case, because we had discovered, you recall, from the Michael Horowitz report that James Comey was using a personal email account, that is a Gmail account, to conduct FBI business. So we asked that, and it turns out that the FBI had never ordered Comey officially to turn over personal emails from that, you know, work-related personal emails from that account.
Let me just make sure we're clear here, Bill Marshall. Jim Comey was the guy presiding over the investigation of Hillary Clinton for using personal email systems and servers for official business as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, this saga is so, you know, rife with irony on top of irony, you know, that you can't, you know, it would almost be laughable if it weren't such, you know, these weren't such serious matters. The court acceded to our request this week, and they said, you know, they ordered the FBI to order Comey to preserve any, you know, Gmails that might contain records that are responsive to our request.
And let me just ask you, Bill, because again, you've been victorious again and again and again in the face of this kind of obstructionism, but you've had an opportunity to spend a lot of time mulling, I'm sure, why it is so. This is, after all, supposedly at least, the Trump administration. This is a Department of Justice under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, a good man. Why is it that we're seeing such efforts to protect the deep state, to protect the swamp, even when that means essentially protecting people who have been absolutely at odds with and subversive to the president and his agenda?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? What is it that they're hiding? And I am absolutely convinced that the actions, the truly desperate actions that we're seeing by the deep state, by the FBI, you know, some people take issue with that term, but, you know, by the sort of establishment embedded elements within the government, the desperation that they show tells me that there's some truly remarkably bad behavior, to put it, you know, mildly, that occurred during the Obama administration that they are desperate to cover up. It's almost petulant now at this point where, and I've mentioned this to you in the past and to other friends, that I'm now seeing responses from the FBI and some of my FOIA requests that I would almost characterize as legalistic childishness. You know, they're actually invoking Glomar. Glomar is a sort of a legal assertion to claim that records can't be released to a FOIA requester because they involve like the most secret of national security programs. But these are responses to requests for records that are very routine that we ask for and get all the time from the government. So I'm asking for, you know, certain FBI officials' calendar entries and, you know, expense reports.
Not national security threats. Let me just ask you very quickly and very directly, if I can. Could President Trump, or for that matter, the Attorney General, not simply make these documents available in the interest of transparency? And if they are not doing that, what interest do they have in protecting the deep state types?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. And I think that's something we all want to know. You know, my boss, Tom Fitton, you know, has called upon the president, you know, ad infinitum to declassify, you know, these records, to release records that we've been demanding for years from the Obama administration. You know, it would seem to be in his interest, in the interest of transparency, in the American people's interest, to make so many of these records, just to release them, declassify them.
Bill, we have to come back to this, and we will do so with you hopefully in the very near future. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your work and that of Tom Fitton and the rest of the Judicial Watch team and your willingness to visit with us from time to time to discuss it. Let's do it soon. With hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.